I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, I visit my dear friend Gail Simmons at her home in Brooklyn. She's a longtime judge in Bravo's Top Chef, an author, an editor, and just an all-around great food mind, and a great friend to me for many years. She's also Canadian, and we have a natural kinship, joined at the hip of patriotism. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it and write a review on your podcast app. That'll help other people find this show. If you're a first-time listener, please subscribe and download other episodes like Carla Hall, Fine Soul Food, and last week's episode, Flynn McGarry Makes a Movie. Here's this week's episode, Gail Simmons Has a Baby. I am in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, New York, with my friend Gail Simmons. How are you?
Hi, Hugh. I'm great. How are you?
I'm really good. It's a crazy world out there.
It sure is. I'm happy you're here in my little cocoon in Brooklyn.
I like your cocoon in Brooklyn. It's funny, coming over from Manhattan, it reminded me, this neighborhood reminded me a lot of parts of Toronto.
Yeah, it does.
Just the diversity of businesses and pedestrian traffic, but also the brownstones, the architecture and things like that. More around like University of Toronto, that area.
It's for me, I find such a relief to cross the bridge now that I live here. My shoulders
it's
relax.
It's a decompression.
Maybe. It is a decompression. That's and it's nice. Green and, well, at the moment it's sort of yellow and orange, but it's a deep sigh of relief, and maybe because it kind of connects me to home a little bit.
Yeah, I love the charge and fury of Manhattan itself, but it always feels like I'm a salmon spawning upstream trying to get through. And this morning with the rain, it was dodging spears and people's umbrellas going into eyes. It's a dangerous world out there. So I was thinking a lot of these days about the differences between Canada and the U.S. And for those who don't know, Gail is from Toronto and I'm from Ottawa, but I have a lot of family in Toronto. And then we both spent a good amount of time in Montreal, me pretending to go to school, and Gail actually going to school.
I did. I went to college.
You went to McGill.
University, as
did
they call it.
Did you go to Havergal in Toronto?
No, but I lived around the corner from Havergal. Okay, I went to Forest Hill Collegiate Institute.
Well, my grandparents' house was in Forest Hill.
What street, do you remember?
It was on 307 Russell Hill Road.
Russell Hill Road. It's a gorgeous street.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous street. And my grandfather was very proud of his house. He worked his way up from the mailroom to be the CEO of Canada Wire. And they had this palatial brick structure. It was just a huge house, dining room table that would fit like 24 people.
My two best girlfriends, really to this day, from childhood, both went to Havergal.
Yeah.
One now lives here with me in Brooklyn, and one is still in Toronto, but I spent a lot of time. I went to summer camp there.
Oh, really? Yeah, my mom went to Havergal. Oh. So, yeah. But, yeah, they living in the States now, I mean, I'm a dual citizen. I've lived here for, 20-some-odd years? More than that, if you include stints in childhood. But it's funny that now more than ever, it could have been pretty homogenous for a while in the early 2000s, that Canada and the U.S. were very similar in a lot of ways. There was some political discord that was very similar in both different areas. You know, the West was going pretty right. But now I think we really see the differences more and more, even though the right wing's really forced its way back into the premiership of Ontario.
Yes.
You thought the Fords were done, but no, they're back
with a vengeance.
They always
there are
come
other,
back.
There are other arms of the family.
I know, luckily, because the first one,
that was a bad moment in Toronto history, political history. It's interesting. I am not a dual citizen. I'm still only a Canadian citizen. I have a green card. I've lived here 19 years. So the fact that I'm not a citizen is purely out of being lazy.
Right.
I have two American children. I'm married to a Canadian. But if you had asked me even 3 years ago, would you ever move back to Canada? And people ask me all the time. In fact, they love to ask me, are you going to ever move back to Canada? My answer was always no. Sort of looking at them as if they're crazy.
Yeah. What's the point?
Why would I move back? My family's here. I own a home here. I have a business here. My husband's business is here. And also, my husband's from Montreal and I'm from Toronto, and they have an infamous rivalry. And my husband is never in a million years moving to Toronto. And I don't want to live in Montreal. As much as I love Montreal culturally and I love the food of Montreal, I don't want to live through those winters. and there would be no work for me there because I'm not bilingual. So we would have a standstill as to where to live. So no, Canada is not an option, would be always our answer to the question.
But
in the last 2 years,
things have changed.
It's never looked better.
It's our
plan B. There's no question. And it's not even a B. I mean, the more I spend time in Toronto lately, the more I realize that there is a pull home that I never actually thought.
Yeah, the pull to me is probably not to Ottawa, but boy, Montreal to me is just a city to live in. And I'm bilingual, but you speak Spanish.
I speak French too, but my French is strong, but I could not conduct my business full on in French at the moment. I went to French immersion school growing up. I lived in Montreal for university.
That's what Westmount's for.
Yeah.
It's totally English.
Exactly right. And that's where my family is in Montreal. Very Anglophone community. But I, you know, just the, what I do is not viable in Montreal if you're not French speaking, native French speaking. All the work in food media for English speakers is
in Toronto.
Yeah. And that's where my family is and my friends are.
And Gail, you and I both have worked recently on a production in Canada, which is that version of Iron Chef Canada, which it was so funny to be back working in Canada.
Yeah.
And then we're way on the east side of Toronto.
Scarborough.
Yeah, I mean, Scarborough, for those of you unfamiliar with Canadian geography and Toronto geography, Scarborough is a huge bastion of amazing immigrant communities all wedged together in a little bit of a rough and tumble town of Scarborough. Yeah. It's kind of suburban, ex-urban almost.
Yes.
But we found some great food. Right,
I went. Now. I was in love with Scarborough. What's funny is the only thing people really know about Scarborough is Mike Myers. Is that where? Isn't that where his most famous Canadian character? Didn't he live in Scarborough?
Where he lived in the basement and
Wayne.
Wayne's World.
Wayne's World. I think took place in a basement in Scarborough.
He has so many characters. Now we're reminded that he was in Halloween because the new Halloween movie came out.
Oh, that's right.
And that's kind of terrifying. And then he was the Austin Powers guy.
Of course. I mean, he's a genius.
He is a genius.
But that was Scarborough, I believe. His sort of childhood growing up in like a shag rug basement in Scarborough. I spent no time in Scarborough growing up in Toronto for the first 23 years of my life, 22 years of my life. And going back to shoot television in Canada this summer, and specifically in Scarborough, everything I wanted was in Scarborough. All the food I wanted to eat, all the Canadian brands I wanted to patron, like, you know, Loblaws, the best grocery store.
Loblaws is our Kroger in Canada.
Yeah. Things like that. But then ethnic food.
Really amazing.
Chinese.
I went to one Chinese restaurant. What was the one? Fisherman's something.
Oh, yeah. That place with the giant lobster
fish
towers.
Fish tanks everywhere. But they only take cash or Canadian debit cards. So, and the bill for three of us was like $700. But it was pretty crazy. And
you
pretty
told me
awesome.
About that.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I need to interview you about this for a second. Did you like shooting Iron Chef Canada? Like, are you happy you did it?
You know, I haven't done competitive cooking in a long time, so it was a little startling.
Not since Top Chef Masters?
Not since Top Chef Masters, really in any real capacity.
Yeah.
And this was, these were intense shoots. You know, you're going into cooking five courses in an hour. You kind of have a bit of an inkling as to what it could be. You've got some menus sketched out. You have a team of two sous chefs, which was actually really nice to actually create a camaraderie of,
right,
of
it's
sorts.
Like very tight.
Yeah, versus doing it alone is kind of lonely and busy and torrid in your head. But this was really good. I really liked it was really hot in there.
Oh, yeah.
The studio under all those lights, even in Toronto, but it was in the summer when we taped, it felt like it was about 140 degrees. So
I think it was.
I wasn't even
over the stove. I was sort of set back from you guys, and I was dying over at the sitting at my monitors.
But, you know, I think that the caliber of chefs we encountered, and these are all chefs from across Canada or Canadian expats, was pretty amazing. I mean, the first episode that airs that I'm in is against Alex Chen, who's at a restaurant called Boulevard in Vancouver. This guy plays seventh in the Bocuse d'Or as the leader of the Canadian contingent.
I was blown away by the talent across the board. I mean, the five Iron Chefs themselves, you, Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy here in New York.
Yeah.
And then three.
Lynn Crawford.
Rob Feeney and Susser Lee.
In
powerhouses. You guys were impressive. And then the contestants or the challengers who fought against you. I you know, because I'm a New York snob and used to all the chefs that I work with here, I wasn't sure what to expect, but they consistently amazed me what they brought to the competition.
It amazed me to a caliber level that was so accelerated and better than what I watched on Top Chef Canada years ago. Mm-hmm. But that can be an anomaly too, because there are even years of Top Chef where you're like scratching your head going, can these guys cook?
Yeah, but they're also at a slightly different place in their careers too. These guys are like at the top of the best restaurants in Canada.
Yeah.
Top Chef is sort of like they're on the verge.
So it was good, but it did get me thinking, and this is constantly that quandary question that we both get is, what is Canadian food?
Mm-hmm.
So what is Canadian food?
I used to not have an answer. I've been working on it. Well, because I've spent a lot more time thinking about it. Again, I used to be a little bit of a snob. Because I left Canada. You know, I left for my career and I left for the food in a lot of ways. And I grew up in Toronto, which is an incredibly diverse, multicultural city, but it didn't feel united in its sort of culinary endeavors at all, Toronto. It was so disparate in a way. And now, especially after spending the summer there shooting Iron Chef Canada and seeing all of these Canadian chefs, I mean, I really think Canadian food is a few things. It's just like American food. There's 10,000 things. American food is totally different in New York than it is in Georgia. That's for sure. Just like Canada is totally different on the East Coast to the West Coast. But I was really amazed by the quality of ingredients in Canada, the natural ingredients, the foraged ingredients. One chef that was on the show that you didn't meet because he wasn't on your episode was a native Canadian indigenous chef in Canada, and he runs a restaurant in outside of Edmonton. He's part of the Cree Nation, and he brought with him the most amazing ingredients, moss and game and pelts and just so many amazing things that I'd never seen before. And to me, that felt like such a privilege because I don't see that here at all. I don't know any Native American chefs who are at that level, who have restaurants at that level, and not because they aren't worthy, but because America hasn't
embraced that.
It turns out, you know, we're still struggling with...
Well, I mean, I think that... Yeah, there's probably so many reasons for that, but the first are the ubiquitous labels of mosaic versus mm-hmm. melting pot.
Yes.
And Canada's always been very keen to be a mosaic of nationality.
His name is Shane Chartrand, and he's cooking outside of Edmonton. And I was just blown away by the fact that it occurred to me I've never seen Native Canadian or American indigenous cooking elevated in that way. And that's sad for a lot of reasons, but really exciting that Canada is in a place where they can celebrate that and that he was able to do what he's doing and that people are responding to it.
Yeah, I mean, the two words, the terms of mosaic and melting pot really jump up to me as really fully defining what we often talk about as the differences between Canada and the U.S. Mosaic implies
it's like less assimilation.
Yeah, well, it's the welcoming of the culture that you come from to exist within that land, as opposed to not forcing, but sort of prescribing an idea, adopting the new culture of the place that you're going to.
Right. I've always said, and this is a bit of a generalization, that Canadians are whatever their heritage is first and Canadians second, whereas in America, you identify first and foremost as American.
But it's so beautiful, though, that level of patriotism that you see in the immigrant population in Canada that has been allowed to keep their cultural adherence to the land they're from, But boy, are they ever proudly Canadian.
Oh, and there's nothing to me that I don't hold more important.
Yeah, it's just, it's very touching. And, as opposed to this new sort of rearing of its head of nationalism in the United States, where that's nationalism is often termed to me to be patriotism gone bad. And that exists in small amounts, obviously in Canada too, but it just doesn't have the sort of bandwidth that it does right here, right now, or the new acceptance of it, which is terrifying.
Right.
But
that's
another
sure.
issue.
I agree.
So, I think that what we know, what we define as Canadian food is so regionally different from place to place. To me, Toronto, there is no Toronto food. Toronto is like the United Nations of the world. It's got more immigrants from different countries than anywhere.
As the biggest Chinatown outside of China. It has four Chinatowns, but the biggest Chinese population outside of China.
Yeah, it's incredibly rich with diversity. Mm-hmm. Then we move over to Quebec, which has diversity as well, but does have a really definable cuisine.
I think so too. Of any place in Canada, for me, Quebec has this rusticity, this hardiness, partially because of the insanely cold temperatures of their winters. But they also have incredible product that they have really used, I think, in the most amazing, ingenious ways. They have a huge duck and foie gras production. Their cheese and their dairy is some of the best in the world.
And unpasteurized, often.
Yes, and unpasteurized because
the
we don't have...
The devil of unpasteurization.
It, right? True enough. And so I really think... And then they have amazing seafood. And even though they're not on ocean... They have a really big culture of
that's a weird
fresh water.
People always say that, but in some essence they are, because as you go up to the Gaspé, that's internal ocean at that point.
I know.
And you go to Joe Beef in Montreal and eat uni sea urchin from the Gaspé,
and their lobster is from Île de Madeleine.
Yeah,
and they also, the St. Lawrence River. That was the entry point for all immigrants during the First and Second World War, where America had Ellis Island. All of my ancestors, my grandparents, great-grandparents, all came through the St. Lawrence River, through Montreal. And that was the entry point of the immigrant community through Quebec to the rest of Canada.
Yeah.
So that I think says a lot too for the hardiness of the stock in Montreal.
Yeah. And walking around Cobble Hill in Brooklyn, you come across a lot of the older Italian families that are still here, though a lot of the area is gentrified a little bit. And but you see the saints and the Jesuses in the front yards, which always reminds me of like Montreal Portuguese neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
Where you've got basically an outside church mixed with winemaking equipment and jugs of stuff, murky things, and then the large statue of Jesus.
There is.
With candles everywhere.
Well, and where we are right now, my home is in the back of a church, an old church that was a Catholic church that became sort of unused because the population of the community was changing so much, and now it was converted to condos. And I'm the gentrifying scum that sort of bought up the condo and changed the neighborhood. But I love living in this neighborhood because there still is a really interesting community here. There is still that old Italian community. There's a lot of old Italian bakeries and pasta shops and butchers, incredible old Italian butchers and bakeries. And then there's also a really big Syrian and Yemen community just north of me by two blocks. And then there's this old Jewish community of Brooklyn that still has pieces in this neighborhood. So I kind of love that there are ghosts of all of these.
And your home is in a church, but a home should be a sanctuary. So you found it.
Yes.
It's good.
For the Jews.
I like that. That sanctuary for the Jews.
Came into the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to break it down this way because I just realized in doing some mind math that I don't wear underwear when I shower, but I wear it the rest of the time. So I shower once a day for 10 minutes. That means I wear underwear for 23 hours, 50 minutes a day. That's crazy. And for years, I couldn't find underwear that, lasted. It fit well. It was comfortable. It was regular. It was just well made. And then I found Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is amazing. And it's for 5, 6, 7 years now. It's all I've really ever worn. They are premium men's essentials brand that believes in smart design and premium fabrics. And Mack Weldon is just better than whatever you're wearing right now. Trust me, I'm wearing them right now. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. The website's great. It's easy to navigate. You get bundles of underwear or undershirts, amazing socks. They have a line of silver underwear. They're naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. They want you to be comfortable at Mack Weldon. So if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they'll refund you. No questions asked. We never ask questions about essentials. Not only does Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well too. Going out, going to work, going out on dates, sitting at desks like I am right now. Just everyday life. It's a Mack Weldon world I live in. I bought them online, and again, it was easy as pie, MackWeldon.com. And right now, if you go online, you get 20% off your first order. Just enter promo code HUGH, H-U-G-H. That's visiting MackWeldon.com, MackWeldon.com, and enter promo code HUGH, H-U-G-H, at checkout. Again, the essentials are essential. Go to Mack Weldon. There are many searches in life. You have many holy grails to find. Mine for the last 10 years that I've been traveling incessantly has been to find a perfect luggage, like a perfect carry-on, a wheelie thing. Let's call it that. Let's call it a wheelie thing. A suitcase. Some people call it a suitcase. And what I've found, after going through many of them, is that they're really, really expensive brands, and they're really cheap brands, not implying any quality. And then I found Away. Away makes an amazing bag. I've been very, very happy with it. They use high-quality materials while offering a much lower price compared to other brands, like much lower price. They have 9 colors and 4 sizes. They're made with premium German polycarbonate, unrivaled in strength and impact resistance. They have 4 wheels, 360-degree spinner wheels, because 350 didn't work. They have 4 wheels. Having 2? Not adequate. Having 1? Definitely stupid. Having 3? Tippy-toppy. Having 4 is perfect. It's a lifetime warranty. Beat that. If it breaks, they'll fix it. Or they'll send you a new one. Both sizes of the carry-on models are available to charge all your cell phones. They have a built-in battery that's removable. It comes with a cord. Charge your tablets, your e-readers, anything else that's powered by a USB cord. A single charge of the Away carry-on will charge your iPhone 5 times. Trust me, that's useful. You get a 100-day trial. Live with it, vibe with it, travel with it, Instagram it. No questions asked. Free shipping on any Away order within the 48 states. Really, I've got a green one, and it's awesome. It's I'm not going to say it's bulletproof, but it's tough as nails. And those 4 360-degree spinny wheels are pretty amazing. Zipping through the airport at light speed. Passing all those people with the cheap bags. Watching that guy with the expensive bags that falls apart upon the airport floor. Sadness will not happen with Away bags. Go and get you a carry-on. Go and get you one of 4 sizes of suitcases. Away is the way to buy luggage. So let's talk about women and cooking and how that's changing and becoming, we're confronting the issues of women not given enough space in kitchens to really succeed on their own. We're still unfortunately giving out awards for best women chefs, mm-hmm. which always seems stupid to me. But people like, you know, Tracy Desjardins and Dominique Crenn and Sophie Peek and all these chefs from around the world who are, can compete equally. There's no gender, shouldn't be any gender specificity in cooking and food and leadership in kitchens. Should have nothing to do with being a man or a woman. Yet we're still hobbled, but we're making progress, we think.
I think we are. I am conflicted internally about this conversation in a lot of ways. I'm not conflicted about the fact that women can cook just as well as men and equally and can be as acute business people and run and mentor and lead in every capacity. I'm conflicted about that woman chef argument only because the reason that the female chef category exists is so that they're not overlooked because they have been for so long. And if we didn't differentiate, so many women would never be recognized.
Yeah,
sadly,
no, I agree.
It's sad. It's frustrating. But that's, I agree with you. And I'm frustrated by the fact that there has to be a separate category. It's chef and woman chef, as opposed to male chef
right,
and female chef.
Right. So maybe that award of best woman chef or whatever, you know, whoever's bestowing that, the 100 best or whatever.
Right.
Maybe that should be made publicly a temporary measure, that it's given a timeline to elapse to give a chance of inclusion to these people. Because I do think we're... Look,
I don't think that James Beard delineates.
No, they don't, and they should never do.
Yes, and they've done a great job in the last few years of it. It just is very equal. They have awarded many, many women.
Which is, the last James Beard Awards were really marked by the fact that people of color and women really were ascendant in the awards and received a good amount of the awards. But I don't want to have that have to be highlighted in the record books like it's, you know, a steroid use in a baseball stats.
Right.
I want it to be that is a natural progression towards tearing off the blinders that we've had on that only looks at, you know, the time cover of the masters of chefdom or whatever.
The gods of you know, the kitchen.
Rennie Redzepi and David Chang and whoever else was on that cover.
I think we have a long way to go. And I think in order to get there with the awards, we have to take several steps back and look at where we're coming from. And there's so many factors in the kitchen that have led us to where we are. And I think we are now woke, so to speak, a little bit more and are hoping to have those conversations openly and honestly and actually and not defensively so that we can actually make progress.
Yeah.
Because we all have to admit that it happened, that we did treat women poorly in most kitchens until recently, that there isn't an equal division. There just isn't. That's truth. I believe that the statistic is still that under 15 or maybe under 20% of kitchens in America are women. That's just a fact. We're getting better. So first we need to know the facts and address them and not get mad at them because they're true. On Top Chef, we're asked this all the time. Why have so many more men won than women? We've done 50. We have 15 winners in the proper show, not the spinoffs. And of those 15 winners, five or six.
Okay.
Of 16, let's say five. I'm not totally sure, so let's fact check this at a later date. But that's actually, compared to the industry, pretty spot on, if not more than industry standard. When you think about the truth of how many women are running restaurants at that level in America.
Right, but luckily that's changing.
Yes.
It is.
But we have
changing.
To look at the industry first before we crap on Top Chef, because I mean, I'm not saying that that's what we're doing, but you know, interestingly, a show like Top Chef has always stacked the deck in some way because we always start off 50-50, which is not indicative of the industry because our hope is to make it more equal. And I know this conversation is not about Top Chef, but it's just an example. And then it's sort of may the best person win. And it is hard to find women at the level that we're at, that we want to be at on the show.
And that's just purely because that's statistical, because it's a smaller part of the industry. But that is changing. You know,
thank goodness.
You know, in Brooklyn, the hottest restaurants are, you know, Missy Robbins places. And that's because... it's got nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman. It's the fact that she's been a badass chef in the trenches for 20 some odd years.
Correct.
And is finally, you know, look, opening up a restaurant can be a lot about luck, but being in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of very successful chefs, regardless of gender, who will fail with good enterprises in the wrong location at the wrong time with the wrong staff.
Something like 50% of restaurants.
Yeah. But Missy's just killing she's it right killing now. It. And it's beautiful to see because she's an amazing person mm-hmm. who's really got such amount of culinary knowledge and skill sets and was the chef at Spiaggia and cooks for the Obamas, and but seemed to fall off the radar for a number of years and then came back just ferociously.
Yeah. Well, part dominate. Of the reason she was able to do that is because she found a partner. She has a single partner in her restaurant who she is very, very close to. And so she found the right partner and backer. And I think that that is the complaint of a lot of women chefs that I speak to. That's where the stumbling block seems to be, is finding supporters and backers financially who are willing to have the confidence and the faith in women to back them with the same money and support and resources that they back when men run restaurant empires. And that is a big hurdle.
I think it is a big hurdle.
As a woman business person, because let's also remember that running a restaurant is a business first and foremost. Yes, you can be a great chef, you can make beautiful food, but the fact is if you don't get the asses in the seats to eat the food, none of it matters, right? It's a business, as you know more than anyone.
And you need somebody, you know, you need anybody who knows how to read a lease well.
Yes.
There are not many chefs in America who are really comfortable and can go up against a 100-page lease from a developer to really know where the pratfalls are in that.
You need a team of people.
And yeah,
you need
it is.
To not and the confidence to know what your strengths are, but also to be able to give them hell,
yeah.
You know? And that's a hard thing for women to do in a lot of ways because I do think to some extent we have been taught to be intimidated by that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's eat some food.
Yeah, let's eat some food. I'm really hungry,
actually. Show me your kitchen.
Come on in.
What'd you make?
I made nothing because I had morning meetings and I have a five-month-old. So, you know, I'm cooking, but today wasn't one of those days.
I'm looking at the baby monitor, but
there's no one in it. That's not a baby. The baby is a baby. It's straitjacket. The baby's sleep sack is in the baby monitor. That's all you're seeing.
The baby is poaching in 83 degree heat.
Yeah, it is deceptive. It's wrong. It's probably about 74.
Okay, good.
But that, I don't know, it's always reading high. For some reason. Where's my knife? So I shopped.
Wow.
I shopped for you. I'm bringing
you. You went to Schwartz's.
Pretty close.
Mile End?
Mile End.
Nice. Good Jewish Montreal.
Yes, voice. I thought I'd bring you a little of Canada and a little of my neighborhood all in one. So there's a lot of food and
big neighborhood.
Yeah, I feel like we should quarter these. It's so massive.
I think we should quarter
them. Yeah, I'm going to quarter them. So I brought you a couple things. Mile End is a Canadian boy who moved here. It was originally, it's changed a bit, but it was originally started by a young Canadian man who moved to New York for law school, realized he hated law school, and started a Montreal-style Jewish deli, but modernized it and opened around the corner from me here in Brooklyn. And it's called Mile End, named after an old Jewish neighborhood in Montreal, which has now also been totally gentrified.
Gentrified.
It's such a great neighborhood.
It is a great neighborhood. It always has been, but it's still, the Montreal Jewish influence is still
strong.
It's so strong and will never go away, I don't think.
Not at all. And it's beautiful. So I got you two sandwiches from him. One is his classic smoked meat, which is different than pastrami. And one is the Walensky, which is totally...
The Americanized.
Stolen from a Jewish shop called Walensky's in Montreal. And he kind of took a version of the sandwich and is making his own version here. And so those are both from Mile End, and also some poutine.
Nice.
I've never once found a good poutine in America.
Poutine in America. Okay, so the big problem with poutine in America is, up until now, the availability of cheese curds has not been properly available.
Cheese curds in Montreal, for people who have never seen them, are like a impulse buy, they sit on the counter. They're not a refrigerated dairy.
But they're really perishable too, which is so weird.
I know, but there they are on the counter. I'm gonna warm this up in the microwave because I'm being efficient.
Yeah.
This is just the gravy.
Tom used his microwave too.
But see, you know what? We're allowed. So I have some poutine from Mile End. I don't know if it's gonna be great or not, but at least That's they know good. What they're doing. It does, and then he puts some smoked meat on top, which is gratuitous.
It's totally gratuitous. Now, this is the problem with an already gut-stopping Canadian icon of foods, which, by the way, poutine, we have no idea who allowed it to escape from Montreal or Quebec as a whole, but it's not supposed to be anywhere else.
No, I know, it's not. That's what I'm saying. I've never had a good one in America.
Yeah, but so poutine is a really simple beef gravy over French fries with cheese curds. That's the classic.
That's it.
Cheese curds melt out.
It shouldn't have foie gras. It shouldn't have, you know.
But now you see it with pepperoni and green pepper and jalapenos and but places that have never actually had a normal poutine.
Correct.
It's a little weird.
So that's that, right. Did you grow up eating poutine at
Yeah,
like,
there
in
was
Montreal?
A truck in Ottawa right down the street from my high school. From Lisgar, so we'd right. go there and get poutine. It was right in front of the Bell Tower on Elgin in Ottawa.
Oh, perfect. So there you go. Me too, but I only ate poutine at 2 o'clock in the morning, like coming home from a bar in Montreal when I was at college. Like that was now you can kind of get it everywhere, but.
Yeah.
So I have the two meat sandwiches and the poutine, and then I went in the opposite direction as I said before, do you want to grab that from the grave?
Yep.
There is a large Syrian community, old Syrian community in my neighborhood, one of the greatest sort of spice and Middle Eastern shops in New York for like Middle Eastern ingredients of all kinds, is a place called Sahadi's, which is right up here on Atlantic. And next to it is a bakery that I love, a Syrian bakery called Damascus Bakery. And I get a lot of food from them all the time because they just make great stuff. And so I got you za'atar bread and some chili, like harissa bread, and then a bunch of dips and some kebay.
Yum.
And meat and spinach pies.
This is the biggest spread we've encountered.
I know, we went a little excited because I'm not good at narrowing down because especially when I go to Damascus.
Well, this is I very Canadian everything. Because it's got about, five identifiable cultures.
Right. That was the hope, you know. I want to be inclusive here. So we'll put a couple of kebay here. And I'm going to just cut these pies up a little bit. And then we can eat. Yeah, pour on the gravy.
And we'll put some pictures up on the Instagram so people can see what we're eating.
Okay, great.
The delightful spread.
So these are pickled turnips.
Those are big pickled
They're
turnips.
They're big, I know. You could cut them in half or just crunch
They're great.
On them.
Yeah.
This is baba ganoush. This is mahamra, which is usually in bread and delicious things. And this is labneh with dukkha and some olive oil. And then this is from Mile End. So this is like the Jewish jelly, traditional, you know, full sour pickle and some coleslaw.
But it's funny. It could be something you'd find at a roadside stand in Israel as well.
Right.
Pickles and cabbage and things like that. So have you spent much time in Israel?
I have spent a little time in Israel. I was in Israel with my family when I was 16. I'm going to get you a napkin. Hold on.
It is a beautiful country. And food-wise, I find it really interesting.
It is really interesting. So I was there I was 16 with my family. And then I went back when I was 18 and I worked on a kibbutz for a few months before college. Mm-hmm. I worked in the chicken farm and then I worked in the kitchen. That was the first professional, industrial kitchen I ever worked in. In Israel, I worked in the north for 2 months on an amazing kibbutz, which is a complicated and fraught way of life, and then traveled across Israel. So that was when I was 18, and I haven't been back. But I'm supposed to go in January. We'll see if that happens.
It's amazing. I went with the couple 4 years ago on a big chef's trip.
Right.
That was really cool. So with Ben Ford.
Oh yeah.
A number of other people.
I kind of remember when that happened.
Yeah, and then
the chili spicy one too
in Montreal. Mm-hmm. What bars did you hang out at along Saint-Laurent?
Oh my goodness, so many.
Like Biff Tech?
Biff Tech, yes. I mean, there was a Peel Pub moment. It's so ugly to think about now. Annie's was a bar I spent a lot of nights in. Angels, there was this bar called Angels, this club at the corner of Saint-Laurent and Prince Arthur that I spent a lot of time in. when I was at McGill. Trying to think of other spots, like it's hard to remember them now. There was, I don't know, a couple of like big club, like dance clubs we used to go to.
And yeah, there was one in Rochelle in San Diego, I forget what it was called. Big one. I lived right around the corner from it. That's why it was.
Did you cook when you were in Montreal?
I cooked in a number of places. I cooked at Buena Notte.
Of course, on Saint-Laurent.
Yeah, when it first opened. Cooked there for a while. And then I had little jobs. I cooked at Mexicali Roses for a while near Concordia, where I went to school. And then pitter-patter around doing some odd things. I used to hang out at Biff Tech most of the time.
It's funny to think we were might have overlapped.
Oh, and I think I'm way older than you.
You're not that much older than me.
I'm 47, just turned.
I'm 42. I say with my mouth full of...
delicious food.
Yeah, it's good.
It's really good.
You know.
I love Syrian food, but every time I eat Syrian food these days, I just think of the devastation there. It makes me so sad because the city of Aleppo is like...
flattened. The children have suffered. I mean, everyone has suffered.
Yeah.
Which is why I kind of want to support the community because... they're really good people in there, really good cooks.
The government of Ontario was doing a program where they would ascertain which Syrian refugees had culinary experience and then put them into, fund a restaurant for them.
Really?
Yeah.
In Syria or in Canada?
In Canada.
Wow.
Which was great.
That's amazing.
They just were triaging and figuring out how people could quickly indoctrinate themselves into the society and become self-sufficient.
Capitalize on their skills.
Yeah, and that's how you have to figure out what their skills are. Because the worst thing you can do is just shove somebody into a society who's got a skill set way beyond what you put them into, and you never really realize it because of lack of communication.
Mm-hmm.
I remember working at a restaurant called Maple Lawn in Ottawa, Canada, when I was young. And I was the young sous chef, strident at 20 years old, and I had a dishwasher named Zong, and Zong was really bright, really interesting older Chinese guy. Not older, but he was in his late 30s, older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And after months of work, he came to me one day and he said, "I have to leave," in halting English. And I said, "Oh, you great, that's fine. Where are you going?" He said, "Well, I'm moving out to Calgary because I got a job at the university teaching nuclear physics." And I was like, "You know what? You should move on. You should have told me these things. I didn't know."
Mm-hmm.
But that's that's our industry in a lot of ways. It's got this attracting notion of everybody under the sun for all sorts of reasons. Eventually works in a restaurant. And some are lifers, and some of it viewed as an art form and a beautiful thing every day that they can learn about. And sometimes it's just a temporary stopping point.
And it's also a thing that everyone can do at any time. You don't need any equipment. You can show up and
do.
Everyone can cook and wash dishes. And
it doesn't matter
who you are. And hopefully where you came from, you can just come and work.
Yeah.
You're willing to put in the work.
Yep. And that's what being a chef was going to be for me before it became my primary motivation. It was just a good trade to fall back on should academics not work out. It became very quickly apparent that academics was not going to work out for me in a very academic family. So lo and behold, here I am. Luckily, I know how to chef.
But but you also sort of maybe in a backwards way were then able to work in a lot of writing and academics years later. So that's sort of amazing that you were able to then write and teach and...
I blame it all on Adderall. I think it just fixed everything.
I think a lot. That's the same for a lot of people, for better or worse.
Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 most popular,
With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at Atchison, A-C-H-E-S-O-N, .robinhood.com.
So what's next? Are you, you're still at Food & Wine?
I'm still at Food & Wine. I've been at Food & Wine for 14 years in various capacities. I'm not there full time.
Food & Wine's had a lot of change in the last few years.
A lot of change. You know, in the last 3 years, we've gone through three different editors and each came with an upheaval of staff. I have hung on for dear life, but I do something very different because I'm not an employee. I'm not there full time. I do a bunch of projects for them, and those projects are changing. I mean, for years, Top Chef was a big piece of what I did for them. Now I do, you know, I have a column, and I'm doing a lot more video and social and event stuff for them. There, for 5 years, I ran the Classic in Aspen, which was an exhilarating, amazing job, but I couldn't do it and also do all the TV stuff that happened simultaneously and have babies. So I love being at Food & Wine, and I'm there. And I'm active there, and I'm constantly in conversation with Hunter, our new editor, but I'm not there
full-time. And that Hunter Lewis was at Cooking Light and a number of other publications over the years, and he's great. Mm-hmm. He's really good, and I think he's that magazine's going to be in a good place with him in the long term.
I think you're right. He's very passionate, and he's earnest, and he takes it seriously, which I appreciate. It's a hard landscape. Media in general, right now, obviously, especially print media, is on its head.
It
and
is.
It's changing every day. And
I think they're figuring it out. Mm-hmm. Their online presence is stronger than ever, and they're making it work. You, for the first time in eons, didn't go to Aspen this year.
I didn't. I had a baby.
Had a baby.
4 weeks before. That was ill-timed on
Which
my part.
Which is funny, because back in 2002, I didn't go to Aspen that year because we had a baby.
Right.
We had our first baby, Beatrice. And that we didn't go to do the festivities for Food & Wine Festival out there, or Aspen Food & Wine. This year it was really good.
Are you going to go back?
Yeah.
Good. I'll be back too. We got to do stuff together a lot, which I always loved.
I know.
I had a baby in May, my second, a little boy named Cole. He's a really good dude so far. Just a happy guy, sweet and easy. My daughter's 5. She's a handful of energy, which I love, but it's exhausting.
It's exhausting when they're like that. But it's also looking at them, and they're sorting themselves out.
They are.
We sort ourselves
testing
out.
Testing boundaries.
You know, I look precocious and emotional is to me are signs in youth of powerful people.
Because
they're just
right.
lining it up in their head.
Yes.
They're figuring out where their strength is.
You're giving me hope.
And they're pushing your buttons.
I mean, you're the dad of 2 girls, and so I always have been in awe of. I mean, girls are. Everyone is their own person.
I have
love
three older sisters and 2 daughters.
That's right.
So it's
you
a
are
crazy
surrounded.
World. But it's amazing, you know, watching them grow up. And, you know, my kids are 14 and 16 now, but they're more so my close friends now. It's
really
funny
nice.
How mature they become so quickly and can converse about everything under the sun and keep up with us on Jeopardy. And, it's great.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. Although I'm loving every stage. Like, I really am. I love having a baby again, which I was very nervous about. Finding the bandwidth in my life to have a second child was not a given for me. And I travel a lot for my work, and I'm dedicated to my work, and I love my work. And so as a mother, that was a complicated balance, still is every single day. Like, getting out of the house in the morning is always a bit of a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am loving every stage of my children's lives. I love having a baby, how much fun it is. I'd forgotten how funny and sweet it is, and how they don't yell at you or talk back or run away. So that's really nice.
Until they learn to talk
Until
and walk and run. Yes.
Poutine?
Poutine.
But I also love my five-year-old who pushes back and is, you know, she just started kindergarten, so she's
feisty.
Feisty, but she's a sponge and she has a million questions and I love her questions. We went on a nature walk this morning before school to pick out leaves because she needed to find different leaves to give to talk about in her class, and we found six different leaves in the neighborhood, and that was like such a wonderful little morning together. You know, all those things that I love so much about the age that she's at.
Sometimes I find kids are great because they remind you of the amazing things around us all the time, mm-hmm. through the unending question of what is that? What is that? What is that?
Mm-hmm.
And
why?
Before and why and how. But before anyone should ever, as a parent, get annoyed by that question, you need to put the prism in front of you that they're looking through and realize, that's so cool.
Yeah.
It's just the age of wonder. Everything's new. And I think we'd be a lot better as humans if we just looked with glee sometimes at,
it's
just
true.
At all of those things and realized, hey, wait a minute, that's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
I know, patience, if there's anything.
Kids.
Children teach you patience, reteach you patience, and it is such a vital, learned skill.
Yeah, but you need to practice it.
Yes,
it requires practice. Patience. It's like, it is a state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, there's an implication with patience of having empathy and not jumping to a conclusion or jumping to a...
Or making assumptions.
As nervous, anxiety-ridden assumption. It's like riding the subway in New York is one of those situations where if you're not going to have any empathy, you're not going to have a good ride. If you're
right.
not going to have patience, you're not going to have a good ride. Just relax.
It's going to come when it's going to come. There's going to be as many people on it as there's going
to
be.
Yeah, we're getting on the escalator to go down at the 42nd Street station. This older woman in front of me with a big bag and blocking the whole escalator. And I was right behind her. But I wasn't giving any signs of being, you know, jumpy about it. But the guy behind me was being. I just kind of shot him a glance. And she looked over at me and she was like, should I move? And I was like, no. I was like, I'm not in any rush. She's like, you must be going to work.
<That's>
I was
funny.
Like, that's good.
Perfect New York moment.
It is.
That's really funny. And it's true. You're right. It is an exercise in patience. And so my children help me with that a lot.
Yeah. I think that's what the world needs is we all need to just have the wonderment of kids a little bit more and be patient with them. They're just, it's so fun to watch them learn though. Man, it's just cool.
It is. It's the best.
Yeah.
And I'm just at the beginning of school, you know, and all of that. I feel like I had children later than a lot of my friends. And in a way that always gave me a lot of anxiety because I'm an older parent and mm-hmm. my parents were older parents to me. And that when I was young was hard because my parents and I had such a generation gap. But I also now have come to realize how valuable that is.
And it's all changed because you're going to live to 120.
Yes, totally. I'm going to live to
medicine.
And I am so much cooler. I mean, I am tapped in. I'm sure my daughter is going to roll her eyes at me just as much as I did at my parents. But I do love that I think it has given me a level of stability and assurance of myself and confidence that I hope to pass on to her. And I think that's really valuable too.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it all turns out in the end.
We're always going to see how it all turns
out.
So are you going back to Canada anytime soon?
I'm actually going back to Canada in 4 days. I'm going on, or 5 days on Sunday. Not exciting, but my father had hip replacement surgery last week. So
Dahlia, my dad had hip replacement surgery. Now he's like running laps again.
Yeah. My dad is an athlete.
Yeah, my dad was a massive athlete. Mm-hmm. Quarterback at
That's
U of
great
T.
great to hear.
Drafted in the NHL.
And it changed him. Like hip replacement was...
Yeah, because, I mean, he was just, stayed and not doing anything, and that was anxiety-ridden for him.
Exactly.
But now movement and just getting out there and playing tennis again every day, I mean, it's
the thought that my dad, exactly, will be able to play tennis and squash and run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a big swimmer, and that, I think, is going to be life-changing for him, so I'm really excited.
Yeah,
and he recovered really well, but he's bored, and he's at home for a couple weeks, so Dahlia and I are going to go.
Whoops. I've often thought about maybe we should get... hip replacements early because it seems such a duress.
Prophylactically?
Yeah. Well, we know genetically they're probably going to go. Might as well just get bionic early. So you guys are going, you and Dahlia are
Dahlia and I are going to go just for, you know, 48 hours to play dominoes and hang out with him and see him and keep mm-hmm. him company. So that'll be fun right before Thanksgiving. And then
that's awesome.
We're back here.
That's great.
Yeah.
And Canadian nice. Thanksgiving is already passed and gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's way different
really,
up there.
You know, I never really celebrated it growing up. It
wasn't Canadian a thing Thanksgiving? For us. We did, but, you know,
Not the same as
it's not the same.
But it's my favorite American adopted holiday by far.
Yeah, but I mean, I just can't keep up with this debate about brining or not brining a turkey.
What do you generally do?
I just salt it
mm-hmm.
like a day ahead of time.
It's like dry brine. Is that what they call it now?
Yeah. You know, pull out a lot of the juices that you want and relax the protein a little bit. Also make sure that the skin's uber crisp and then just cook it. But the idea of deep frying turkeys with Hopping John Taylor made famous years ago in a Vogue magazine article written by Jeffrey Steingartner.
My old boss. You know that?
Jeffrey. Yeah. Wow.
I worked for him for over two years.
Hmm.
I was his research and recipe assistant right when I left kitchens.
Okay.
I was a line cook, but I knew I wanted to write. I sort of went to culinary school and went into kitchens to get the experience knowing I wanted to write about it. And I was working as the garde-manger at Vong restaurant, Jean-Georges.
Yeah.
Thai restaurant that doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And read Jeffrey Steingarten's book, The Man Who Ate Everything. And it was a life-changing book to me. It was the most brilliantly written book about food I had ever known. I didn't know who he was. I'd never read Vogue magazine. And I went to my career services director at my culinary school and said, do you know this guy? Like, this guy.
Where did you go to culinary?
Well, it was Peter Kumps when I was there. Now it's the Institute of Culinary Education.
Yeah.
And I...
That's the ICE we want fully funded and
operational. Yes, right. That's the right ICE. The other one, not so much.
Not so much.
So I went to them and said, do you know this guy? Because he's amazing and I want to be his assistant. Because he talks about his assistant in his book. And she does all the things that I wanted to do. Recipe testing and research and running around New York City and, you know, spending time at the library and spending time at the Green Market and in Chinatown and on, you know, Arthur Avenue in the Bronx. And my culinary services director said, I know Jeffrey and I know he's looking for an assistant. And 5 days later I had the job.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. And that's why I never left New York. Otherwise I would probably gone home to Toronto, but I ended up working for Jeffrey for 2 years. I wrote his second book with him and did all his research and all of those things. It was an incredible education. It was the most difficult. He is.
Okay, good.
He's not in great health.
Right.
But he is arguably, I think, the greatest food writer of our time.
I think he's an amazing food writer. And that article was really, mm-hmm. this is years and years ago in mm-hmm. Vogue, but probably around 1990s.
Yeah.
93. And it was all about deep frying a turkey, which is the worst way to cook turkey. And also, you have more likelihood of getting a good turkey out of it than you do. You're much more likely to burn down your house than get a good turkey out of it.
Do not try this at home.
No. And not under your garage, under the canopy, on the wooden porch.
All of those things. That seem obvious. You can Google the video. When you say them out loud.
When you say 400 Fahrenheit degree oil and a barrel of oil. Watery bird going into it. That's not a great combination.
Terrible. Wouldn't do that. I don't want to do that. Are you hearing that siren?
Yeah, it's inevitable. We're in Brooklyn.
It's the BQE.
Too bad.
All right.
Well, Gail Simmons, thank you for feeding us.
You're welcome.
This has been wonderful. Thank you for being the most wonderful expat Canadian I know.
Thank you. I'm honored. And, I'm so happy that I got to see you.
I know. I miss your kids, though.
I know. I'm actually surprised that Cole hasn't come back because it's raining out, but he probably fell asleep.
He can't walk far.
No, he can't go far, but my nanny's probably just walking in circles around the block.
He's probably asleep then.
That's good. What I'm assuming.
That's good. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Get it on.
Of course.
This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped by Brian Blum on location in Brooklyn, New York. Scott Porch produces the show, and Mackenzie Mazzell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and come back Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison. Thanks for listening. Eat well. Be swell. Don't collude.